Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. We're joined this week by the creative and versatile polymath Anthony McCann. As a keynote speaker, after-dinner speaker, consultant, coach, trainer and facilitator, he inspires people to reimagine and redesign their relationships, working environments and communities through a better understanding of proximity, power and possibility in their lives. His work is based on 20 years of original research and teaching across the humanities and social sciences, and also of practitioner experience in leadership, community development and performing arts. He's here to talk to us today about the Gary Ocht Manifesto, more an invitation than a message when it comes to professional life. Trust your humanity. The manifesto offers a human scale and humane set of principles for sustaining the heart of being human in the art of being human in professional life. Hello, Anthony. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Thank you very much.
Okay, could you perhaps begin by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you came up with this idea of the manifesto?
Well, I wear a lot of different hats, and I think that's one of the reasons I came up with it. I wear a lot of different hats. I was an academic for about 20 years, and I worked across the social sciences and humanities. So I worked in anything from Irish language, folklore, heritage studies, right through to cultural theory, social theory, critical legal studies, design, cultural policy and management, various other things. So I had a very broad experience in the academic world as a scholar and as a researcher and as a lecturer. And about 6 years ago, I took voluntary redundancy from a university position. And since then, I've been working independently as a scholar and researcher while doing a whole pile of other things. So yeah. I sometimes work as a children's entertainer. I sometimes work as a poet. I sometimes work as a voice actor and many, many other things. I also work for the BBC and for RTE Radio in the south as well of Ireland. So I have a very varied career, largely because I also have the responsibility of being a caregiver at home, and we have two young children as well. So that means that I do what I can to stay in and around the home base of Bangor in Northern Ireland. So whatever I can do that allows me to do that, I do.
Brilliant. Okay, well, so what is, first of all, what is Gary Ocht? And have I pronounced that correctly?
Absolutely correctly, yes. Gary Ocht is really, it's just a fairly straightforward word in the Irish language. It's not a word that many people tend to use much these days. It was quite a familiar word colloquially in Ulster and in Connacht in the west of Ireland many, many years ago. And I first came across it in some Irish language texts from around the turn of the century, particularly the work of a short story writer called Seamus Magarina from Ranafast in Donegal, northwest Donegal. And it just kind of popped up in my studies, and I didn't pay it much heed at the time. It was a word that spoke of the literal reality of someone being in a position seated nearby you and being in a position to help you. And so the first time I came across it was the idea that somebody was near the fireplace, and that's where what the person wanted was. Therefore, the person was in a place of Gary Ocht. And the reason it has this sense of proximity and helpfulness is because of the very word itself. Gar, as a noun in Irish, can mean favor. And Garach or Gari can mean helpful as an adjective. And there's this very deep imbrication between helpfulness and proximity in the Irish language, not only with this word, but with other words as well that I've been looking at for the last couple of years. And one of the things that fascinates me about the word Gary Ocht is also that it's a verbal noun. So it's always an activity. It's always an active notion. So it's being active, being near, and being in a position to help. So beyond that literal sense, I'd already been working in the area of culture change quite a lot and system change. And I realized that the word encapsulated all of those things that I wanted to be able to say in my work very, very straightforwardly. So I started to use the term Gariyacht not only to speak of that literal sense of being near and being able to help, but also of a deeply figurative sense of that quality of relationship in which helpful qualities of being human simply tend to happen.
Okay. So why did you decide to form it into a manifesto? What was it you liked about that setting for it?
Well, I didn't. I don't like manifestos. the only manifesto I've ever liked is the Agile manifesto, because it was very, very brief. It was simply a group of people who had been working in the software industry who suddenly said to themselves, we'd like to be a little bit more human here. And they set up 4 or 5, maybe more now, principles for adopting a more personal and human practice and being more aware that they were dealing with people on a daily basis. So the spirit of that was something that I very much went along with. I'm not necessarily going along with a lot of agile practice at the moment that's out there, but the idea of the Agile Manifesto was very inspiring to me. And one of the things that I always found difficult in my own work was that I have a tendency to go cerebral, so I have a tendency to go upwards and head towards the more abstract and kind of comparative and universalist qualities of the work that I do. My father was a philosopher, I'm a philosopher in turn, and that often made it difficult for me to communicate some of the things that I wanted to communicate to more than a very small number of people. So in some ways, the Gariyacht Manifesto is near the end of a 20-year journey of trying to find ways to talk about this work in a more ordinary fashion. Because it's one thing to celebrate the ordinary and celebrate the ordinary, the everyday, and to celebrate that sense of the quotidian that many, many philosophers have talked about over the years, and feminists and indigenous thinkers and many other people. But what I found was that for many, many years, I was talking about the ordinary and the everyday with a language that was quite inaccessible to most people's experience of the ordinary and the everyday. Now, this was quite ironic because at the same time, I write poems and songs that are about as ordinary as you could possibly imagine. Big plug, my new collection of poetry is just out this week. But that was always a tension for me. It was, how do I increasingly find ways to render my philosophical work poetically and render my poetic work philosophically?
Okay. Well, let's have a look at the principles. I certainly find them, they have a very sort of pragmatic component to them, but there's something quite beautiful about them in their simplicity, in a way. But so to begin with, the strap line for the manifesto is trust your humanity. So what do you mean by that?
One of the important things for me over the years has been to make as few decisions as possible. Now, this is not only in response to classic rational decision-making notions of human nature, but also that I've found it more helpful to make as few decisions as possible, because the more decisions I find I have to make, the less I feel I've been listening to what's been going on beforehand. And I'm a great believer now in feeling my way and intuiting my way as much as possible through situations. And what I found was that the more I worked on listening, the more I worked on becoming aware of what was around me and who was around me and how I was in and of the world, the more I realized that I could simply trust that when I entered into a situation, that I could actually just respond to it in the moment. Now, if I were stressed or, you know, angry and all these sorts of things, then yes, of course, it was going to be more of a difficulty. Being hungry as well, I'm sure, is an issue. But generally, I found that the reason I place so much emphasis on trusting your humanity is that we make such an effort to plan or strategize before we go into situations. And the more of an effort we make to do that, for me, the less we allow ourselves to enter into those situations in a deep, responsive awareness. And for me, that deep responsive awareness is where we're at. And we're going to be more helpful to ourselves if what we're learning in that context, in that situation, is something that allows us to develop where we're at. And if we're not bringing that to the situation, then that's going to be counterproductive one way or another. So trust your humanity is very much the idea that, you know, we can actually trust that the person that we bring within a situation, that we are the best cultural barometers we could possibly hope for.
Yeah.
And that is enough, and that we are enough, and that we are sufficient. Maybe sometimes we don't feel we are on our own, but we certainly are sufficient together in terms of what we can bring to a situation.
Yeah, I'm by and large, yeah, I agree with that. I suppose there's just one caveat. I'm just thinking of cognitive bias theory, and in particular, Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow. Now, he gives an example of someone in the fire service who had 20 years experience, goes into a fire and intuitively just knows what to do because they've had that wealth of experience behind them to react. But also, you know, at the beginning of the book, he gives that classic example of a bat and a ball cost £1.10. The bat costs £1 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? Now, most people actually intuitively just go into system one thinking and say it's 10p, and the answer is actually 5p. You have to go into your sort of systems two thinking. So I'm just saying that, you know, that our intuition is a shortcut, and it's often right, but it's sometimes we get it wrong. How do you build that into that trust your humanity concept?
The background to all of this work is what for a long time I called the cultural climate framework. And it's a way of talking about variabilities in atmosphere, variabilities in intensity, emotional intensity, in the way that we both bring our dispositions to a situation and also experience the dispositions of a particular environment. But one of the key principles of that work has been trying to find ways to show how the more intense an environment becomes, the more probable it is that we will experience structural blindnesses to our participation within that environment. And one of the key challenges and invitations of any consciousness-raising work is very much how do we identify the likelihood of our own blindnesses, our own biases, but also how can we start to kind of diminish their power within ourselves. And not that there's any purity that we can ever achieve, but the sense that there are certain gross distortions and gross misrepresentations which tend to be very characteristic of highly intense environments, symbolically, linguistically, cognitively, which we can identify. There are certain things like stereotypes and wild generalizations and very poor metonymies and, you know, so on and so forth, that simply do not provide accurate representations of what is going on, but more importantly, provide deeply and grossly misrepresentative renderings of what's going on. And I think that's one of the challenges of therapeutic work, whether it's psychotherapeutic work or trauma work or whatever, is that understanding of how distortion happens and how our very distorting understandings of our realities can lead to ways of thinking about ourselves or situations that are just completely off the mark, and leave us being in deep dissonance and conflict with the realities that we find around ourselves and within ourselves.
And it is a part of that, perhaps cultivating an openness to being wrong and a sense of curiosity.
Well, that, for me, again, going back to trusting your humanity, that these sorts of things for me simply start to be part of your makeup if you avoid the elimination of uncertainty. I talk about the elimination of uncertainty rather than certainty, because people often talk about certainty and mean confidence. So if you're telling people that they shouldn't have certainty and they think that you mean confidence in what's going on, then they get very scared. So, you know, the elimination of uncertainty is the sort of the cognitive structure that people tend to use when they're trying to think that certainty can be or should be eliminated. So, you know, they try and, you know, eliminate the impurities or eliminate the lack of control or eliminate the whatever it happens to be on that particular day, in that particular moment. So it's the elimination of uncertainty for me is one of the key touchstones of what leads to these gross misrepresentations. And it's not about the contamination of elimination of uncertainty. It's about if there is a dominance of elimination of uncertainty thinking within one's disposition, within one's context, environment, then that will bring certain trajectories and certain dynamics which will accelerate and intensify and become seemingly autopoetic and self-reinforcing. And I think it's when these sorts of ways of thinking, these deeply, grossly misrepresentative ways of thinking become normalized as the way things are and the way things must be, we experience a sense of almost reality shock in the way that we experience things. And that for me is a very, very important part of it. And it's trying to combine that understanding of reality distortion with a sense of personal reality shock, but then also a sense of, three things I have identified in my work as being characteristic of deeply unhelpful contexts or deeply unhelpful dispositions are chronic heightened intensity, chronic heightened directivity of should, must, need to, have to, or heavy push, heavy pull, and chronic domineering elimination of uncertainty in thought and language. What I've found is those three things are not only found together, but they're direct correlates of each other. And that's the key to the cultural climate framework, is understanding the dynamic whereby the more intense an environment becomes, the more appropriate it becomes for people to think in terms of elimination of uncertainty, and the more appropriate it feels for people to turn to highly directive ways of being in the world and being of the world, or often being separate from the world. So that leaves us with it, and you can come from any angle on that, that the more directive things become, the more intense things become, so on and so forth. It's particularly important in issues like gun control at the moment in the United States. But that so many of the activist things that people do head for the point of highest intensity and the point of highest of almost clear opposition. And part of this work has shown me that the more we head towards the intensity, it's very Aikido and it's dynamics really, but the more you head towards the point of highest intensity, the more counterproductive your work is going to be, unless you are a complete Zen master in trying to distinguish yourself from the situation. Because if you are not going in with a real sense of embodied somatic awareness into a situation that's highly intense, then the probability is that you will be swept along by the dynamics of what is in the situation. Because another one of the notions that I've been playing with is building on Stuart Kaufman's work around the idea of the adjacent possible. And I've built on that the idea that things tend to develop in relation to what is kind of nearby. They won't suddenly make huge leaps of kind of natural illogic. But the adjacent probable is a term that I now use, building on that, which is that within any particular environment, particularly intense environments, that people tend to default as a first and as an oppositional response, first and second response, tend to default to those dynamics that will reinforce the dynamics and dispositions of that environment. So this is very unhelpful when it comes to toxic environments or highly, highly intense environments, even disaster environments, in that people's first response, whether in celebration of what's going on or in opposition to what's going on, will tend to make things worse. So that's one of the difficulties when I talk about, when I use the word probable in any of the text that I use on the website, I'm very, very specifically referring to that type of dynamic.
Okay, so can you just give us an overview then of the main principles of the manifesto?
The original manifesto was one principle. It was quality of relationship before outcomes. So the seven principles that I have on the manifesto are sort of ways to unpack that a little bit. The first, personal before professional, is a way to invert the old cliche. It's business, not personal.
Right.
And it's a way to say that actually, you know, everything is personal and everything is political and everything is ethical and everything is, you know, so personal before professional, because professional is always personal. And again, it's personal before professional. It's not saying personal, not professional. I'm all for professional. Presence before purpose. The heart of this is that the quality of relationship within a situation is more important than the intention you bring to it. And that's the heart of this idea of presence before purpose, that just be in the room. Be in the room, be aware that you're in the room, and be aware of what's going on in the room. Sometimes your purpose will be driven by the mindset or disposition that you brought from a different room, in a different group of people. So that might not be appropriate to helpfulness within that particular environment. So that's the kind of idea there.
Okay.
So questions before statements. This was always a difficult one for me because I kind of grew up with the type of attitude that where I was kind of person who would say statements a lot before questions. It's ask questions before making statements and question other people's statements is really the principle here. Just always introduce that sense. We were talking earlier about that sense of, you know, questioning and humility, and, you know, always undermine that sense of elimination of uncertainty through questioning and realizing that any declarations about the world and the way it is and the way it must be are always open to question. And that's part of the hope of the world that we live in.
Great.
Invitation before message. This is a very important one for me, that I feel that anyone who tries to spread a message, they may be very clear about the attitude and disposition with which they spread the message in the first place, but once the message goes beyond them, then quality of relationship is not part of quality control. They have no control over what disposition people adopt as they spread the message. So something became very important for me was the idea of wanting to issue an invitation to a particular quality of relationship rather than issue a message. And I've seen this at work, in particular in the work of John McGee in Gentle Teaching. He was a nurse in mental and physical health care. And he had two groups of people who followed his work, from what I could see. One was a group largely in America, which were pretty much disciples who followed him like a guru, which he had very little time for. And the second group were people in Scandinavia who followed his gentle teaching, his practice of gentleness in healthcare, as a way of working in the world, and as an attitude that they would adopt with people they worked with. And I found that difference between the American, for the most part, American group who followed his message and the Scandinavians who followed his invitation. And I found a very different, a far lower level of intensity among the Scandinavians and a far higher level of intensity among the Americans. And I found it very uncomfortable to hang around the disciples, as did he.
So the manifesto itself, presumably, then, is an invitation.
Very much so. Very much so. And it's an invitation to say, look, this is something that I found helpful and continue to find helpful in my work. And it's a way to frame many things which I find helpful. Meaning before metrics is another one of these, you know, key things where people are jumping for ways to measure everything, in particular, you know, psychometrics and organizational metrics. But metrics for me make little sense unless you have a story clarified as to what use are you going to put these metrics to, what values do you stand for, what understanding of human nature do you stand for, how are they going to be helpful? And if they're not going to be helpful, why are you doing them in the first place? So, you know, this question of meaning before metrics is simply saying, don't just measure everything for the heck of it. And don't just think that just because you describe things in greater detail because of measurements and metrics, that somehow this has helped. Because if descriptions don't lead to explanations, which don't lead to sense of our own participation in something, which doesn't lead to a sense of transition to a more helpful environment, then the metrics were no help in the first place. So, you know, that's the kind of heart of that idea.
Yeah, makes sense.
Helpfulness before planning comes down to probably the core question of my work at the moment, which is how do you know what you're doing is actually helping if you think it is? I asked this question of a group of students in a peacebuilding class, and they had never, ever been asked this question before, and many of them had worked in the field professionally. You know, how do you know what you're doing is helpful? And there is no field of helpfulness studies, and there should be, because it's the heart of every discipline nearly on the planet. is helpful for what? Helpful to do what? Helpful as what? You know, what constitutes helpfulness? And that's one of the core assumptions of every aspect of every disciplinary work. But again, not something that tends to be explored very much beyond helping behavior or pro-social behavior in psychology.
Yeah, it's sometimes you can be helpful but unhelpful. Like, you know, you might giving sweets to begging children. You know, you might think you're being kind, but you're not being wise there, are you?
Well, this is why I focus on helpfulness rather than helping behavior or helping or help, because helpfulness is a quality of the environment, and you're just a part of that environment. And it's a quality of environment in relation to whether or not you intensify or de-intensify, escalate or de-escalate the quality of that climate. And that's where your intentions sort of become a little bit irrelevant in some ways. And there's so much emphasis on intention in law of attraction work and self-help work these days. But for me, intention is neither here nor there. The question is, suspend your intention. Take a look at what's going on, suspend your justification, suspend your explanations, which ties into some NVC work as well. But, you know, really try and come to grips with that deep listening that's required to understand consequence and participation and the effect that of shaping and shaped environments as we go along. Which comes to the last one, which is mood before management. That for me, the feel of a situation is the primary cultural driver of everything in that situation. And that's something which people are starting to come to grips with, but there's no getting around that. That people talk about all these, you know, drivers for this, that, and the other. How do you want it to feel for yourself and others is my primary question. And this relates also to something which I've been calling recently Hitler's razor, which is something I've been thinking about in relation to a lot of management and leadership work recently, which is, you know, to what extent are the techniques and tools that you're using in your management and leadership similar or exactly the same as what Hitler would have used himself? And that's something which, for me, highlights that so much management and leadership work these days and organizational work is pretty much ethically a loose cannon, that there is very little ethical quality to what's going on because there's so much urgency to be entrepreneurial, to change, to make a difference. The same thing goes for the social innovation scene. You know, there's so much of a rush, a gold rush, really, for the best idea or the best economic hit or whatever it is. And I think urgency is not our friend.
Yeah, that makes me think about some organizations where they've been exploiting tax loopholes, etc. And they've said, well, we're not doing anything legally wrong, but they're arguably doing something morally wrong. But they're quite comfortable with making that distinction. And you're saying perhaps we need to bridge that gap to some extent.
I think also to shift back to talking about ethics rather than morals. For a lot of people, morals are related to either a set of rules or a set of doctrines or a set of future telos, eschatos, whatever you want to call it, of a world still to come. And for me, ethics and situational ethics is very much, you know, little nod to Fletcher there somewhere. Situational ethics is very much a question of that responsiveness in the moment and that sense of quality of relationship and that sense that, and I'm actually have been going back to a lot of my early experiences in terms of history of early Christianity and things, of the deep political and ethical challenge that was there in the radical and inclusive hospitality of the likes of Jesus Christ, where I'm not an evangelical Christian at all, but I'm fascinated by the political and ethical import of a lot of the personal and the political notions that were embedded within the more radical and human dimensions of what I was raised in terms of Catholicism and Christianity, and my dad was more of a liberal theologian, so you know it wasn't exactly conservative stuff I was raised with anyway. But that again comes back to this idea of, you know, you can tell yourself all the lies in the world about how well you're doing, but at the end of the day, is it actually helping? And that was one of the challenges I had growing up as a child, and it's also one of the challenges I again have now as an adult.
Well, that sort of ties into, and I'm not sure if it's the last principle, but it's certainly the last point you make in the manifesto. Start where you are. By that, do you mean whatever ethical decisions you've made in your life up to that point, then you can start now and start to try to live a better life.
Yeah, I think it's got to do with, in some ways, with the idea of disposition. And, you know, this is an idea that, you know, goes back right through the likes of Aristotle and everyone else as well. But disposition keeps popping up again and again in philosophical terms throughout the centuries. But whatever you're bringing to this moment is the cumulative effect of all the experiences that you've had to this point. And dispositionally, you will have a consistency, general consistency of response to uncertainty, to intensity, to directivity, because of the cumulative structural effect of all of those experiences. Now, that is something that we can change, but it takes time to change dispositions. So you cannot suddenly automatically say, I am now a changed person, I am now converted, I'm now, you know, yeah. I'm now woke. You know, you can't say that because it's not going to work. The quicker you think you can change yourself, the less likely it'll be helpful. The quicker you think you can change any situation, the less likely it is to be helpful, because even situations have dispositional characteristics that take time to transition to something more helpful. So start where you are is very much a call to patience. And it's a call to the patience and humility that's required to do the work, to actually say, you know, that gauge where you are dispositionally, listen to yourself, gauge where you are, and listen to the situations you find yourself in. Think about what is important to you and think about what you want to be important to you, and allow those two things to dance, because it takes a long time for them to dance. And through that dance of what is important, what do you want to be important, how do you want it to feel, you start to work it out. And you can trust your humanity, trust your cultural barometer, trust your personal barometer. You start to work out slowly, little by little, as you start taking care of yourself, you start to work out what feels right, what doesn't feel right. You start sometimes realizing the patterns that you keep going back to that start, you know, being a little bit sadomasochistic, you know. And I'm speaking with someone here who has had, you know, anger problems, as someone who has had, you know, sugar addiction problems, so on and so forth. You know, that there are many patterns in my life that I haven't been terribly proud of. And that's part of the journey, is trying to identify those patterns, those things that you still have to deal with, and will probably always have to deal with, but that's it. That's what you get to deal with. You start where you are.
Yeah. And how do you get the balance between not beating yourself up and being kind to yourself, but also engendering that change?
I tend to stay away from blame, guilt, and shame, and which is a very un-Catholic thing for me to say. I'm very aware of the power of the drama triangle, Stephen Cartman. So within these unhelpful dispositional characteristics and intensities and atmospheres, the drama triangle tends to take over. So you either are victim, perpetrator, or rescuer, or all three, or just two of them, or whatever it is. But you tend to throw those around willy-nilly all over the place. And the other drama triangle is blame, shame, and guilt, which is sort of the underside of victim, perpetrator, rescuer, and they kind of go back and forth around each other like that all the time. So by trying to not feed blame, shame, and guilt, you also then find yourself not feeding victim, perpetrator, rescuer. And if you only start with staying away from victim, perpetrator, rescuer as one thing, or staying away from should, must, need to, have to, these little things, a bit like the exercise of changing the way you do your toothpaste every day, these little exercises build up, and you start. You know, you could reframe it all, and I've thought about it a lot, as reframing it all as sort of a 30 kata for, you know, ethical living, where you have these little exercises that you just put together in the way that you would with martial arts. It's about tiny little moments of just reorienting awareness. And so it's not about big efforts. It's about every step being a tiny, tiny, tiny step. And there's a really bad movie called What About Bob? Is that what it's called? The Richard Dreyfuss movie? Really?
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
Bill Murray.
Baby Steps.
Yeah, the Baby Steps comes from that for me. It's a terrible movie, but I hate it a bit. but this idea of baby steps, that's all you're ever working with, and that sense of proximity, that sense of, you know, every situation isn't beyond your consciousness. Every situation flows on from the last one. Within your consciousness.
Yeah. You've just created an urge for me to see that film again now.
I don't want anybody else to see that film.
Anyway, in what environments do you see this manifesto being particularly effective? Do you have any environments particularly in mind, or is it just a general manifesto for soldier into action in life, and you know, for you personally too?
For me, the place where this manifesto fits most is within groups or organizations, or even within a personal life, where people have very explicit good intentions about making a helpful difference in the world. Because one of the reasons it was created is because I've come across in my life so many situations where groups and organizations and people have found themselves being undermined in their work by the tools and techniques that they tend to use. So I keep going back to Neil Gaiman's quotation from Sandman, you know, that tools, of course, can be the subtlest of traps. And that, for me, is the place for this. It's the people I love working with are the people who find their organizations changing in ways that they don't want them to be, despite their best intentions. And they're being influenced by admin, by bureaucracy, by diktats of funders, whatever it is. But they have these wonderful good intentions, and then that somebody tells them they need to scale. So they scale the organization, and suddenly they find the organization has changed in terms of the feel of it, in terms of the quality of the relationships they have with people. And those are the people I'm really interested in working with, are the people who know that they don't want to be doing things this way, but don't know how it got like this. And there's got to be some way that they can get back to the core humanity of what they got into this for in the first place. And that's the heart of the manifesto for me, is it's a kind of reminding ourselves of the, as I put it elsewhere, that the heart of being human and the art of learning, about ourselves and about our situations. And it's coming back to that sense of the heart of being human. And not everybody wants to do that. A lot of people proclaim they do these days, but not everybody really wants to. But there are people and there are groups who have committed themselves, at least in intention, to being more helpful in the world. And what I would say to those people is, helpful is not always appropriate, and appropriate is not always helpful. And that's something that needs to be reflected on, and that is complex. And it's complex because of the distortions that distance us from our understandings and awareness of the possibilities of our own humanity.
I imagine for a lot of people in business, still arguably the dominant paradigm in business in the West is, you know, is a bit cutthroat and hierarchical, and we'll see this as, oh, you know, it's it sounds great, but it wouldn't work in practice.
Well, you know, people is as people does. It's like night follows day. If you want to go down that route, that's fine, but I can tell you what your organization is going to look like after 20 years. You know, that I know the Garriott Manifesto is possible because it isn't utopian. It isn't describing some ideal situation that I want in the world. It's describing experiences that I have experienced on a daily basis and that I continue to experience on a daily basis. This type of way of being in the world does exist. And not only that, has been shown to give a far more sustainable over time return on an investment, if people want to talk in those terms, than other ways of being in the world. The distortions that come with the more intense ways of being in the world, we're just lying to ourselves that this stuff works better. It doesn't. It's unsustainable. The only way to keep a really toxic organization sustainable is by changing the staff all the time, which means it looks sustainable in the same way that Manchester United looks like the Manchester United of 30 years ago, but it ain't the same thing, right? So, you know, it's, and the quality of relationship within that space is so poor that, I'm not saying anything about Manchester United here, I'm saying about organizations.
Yeah. That be careful.
I've got to be very careful. Jose, please. You know. But that sense that, what is it, the average lifespan of a CEO in the business world is 13 months.
Wow.
And that's pathetic. I'm sorry, but that's pathetic. Yeah. If you're talking about organizational learning, if you're talking about organizational heritage, if you're talking about tradition within organizations, that cannot be maintained. And it just becomes a Fordist assembly line approach to organizations. And hey, look, Dr. Phil, how is that working for you? The world is in a mess.
Yeah.
Okay. And we don't have to look beyond Brexit to see what happens when that level of distortion and detachment of an organizational form from the people they seek to represent becomes such a sustained crisis of distortion, where it almost doesn't matter. They don't really care that things are so bad. They just keep rolling it out. And that's fine, but it's not going to work. And it's going to cause havoc, and it's going to cause destruction, and people are going to die. And this is what it really comes down to, is if we keep running business and running organizations as if we were all members of the curt brutish short life that past philosophers have claimed that we live, then a lot of people are going to suffer, and a lot of people are going to die through self-harm or otherwise. And that's not good enough. That we are heading towards, in very real terms, we're heading towards extinction. And these are things which are easy to kind of brush under the carpet, but it's all part of the big picture, that trying to find a way of being in the world and of the world for yourself is your own responsibility, your ability to respond in a way that is helpful, not just for yourself, but more helpful for those around you, with the deep ripple effects that come with that.
Mm.
And being toxic also has deep ripple effects, potentially deeper ripple effects. And trauma takes a long time to heal, but happens really, really quickly.
Being
helpful happens really, really slowly and takes a long, long time to work. And it's patient work and it's slow work, but it's the only thing that is actually going to work. So no matter how fast we run at all this stuff, the faster we run at it, the more less helpful it's going to be. So, you know, this is why I'm saying about the urgency, about the, you know, the self-interest, about all that sort of stuff. Fine, throw yourself at the wall, run into the fire, whatever you want to do. That's not what I'm about. And the invitation, rather than the message, is, look, if you also would rather not fool yourself and take greater consideration of what is actually going on and be less distorted in your approach to things, then maybe respond to mine or somebody else's invitation to take that less urgent and more listen-y approach to being in the world, of the world, and not separated from the world in some sense of access, control, and ownership, and resource management.
Great. Okay. What's your understanding of the middle way, Anthony, in relation to what we've been talking about today?
It's fairly shallow. I was aware of the middle way in terms of, you know, Buddhist traditions of the middle way back down through the years. And I've been reading a few things of the Middle Way Society, bits of the website, bits of the literature. Generally, it seems to fit quite a lot with a lot of things that I'm interested in myself. It's a different set of language than I'd be using myself sometimes, and sometimes overlaps, sometimes doesn't. But I'm not that familiar with it. I just get the sense that there's some strong affinities there, and I'm always on the lookout for conversations and communities and contexts where I find strong affinities.
Great. Okay, and my last question. If people wanted to find out more about the manifesto and your work in general, how would they go about it?
Well, probably the quickest way would be go to anthonymccann.com, because that's easy to remember. And I am Anthony McCann, the Northern Irish poet, not Anthony McCann, the American poet. And there are a few links there to the Garryocht website. I'm actually thinking about bringing everything into the anthonymccann.com website at the moment, because things are a bit scattered. And just take a look at what's there. Everything I'm doing, whether the songs or poems or philosophy or, you know, Garryocht stuff, everything I do comes from the same place. So, like, one of the books I'm working on for the next 10 years probably is called The Best Maps Always Bring Us Home.
Oh, what a great title.
My son came up with it. He was 4 and he was sitting in the back of the car and he had a takeaway menu in his hand. Is that a menu, Aidan, you've got in your hand there? He says, no, it's a map. And I says, is it indeed? And where is that map going to take us? Home. Okay, and then turn to start the car, and then he just says randomly, the best maps always bring us home.
Fantastic.
So I'm very interested at the moment in exploring how my learning and my education largely brought me away from myself in many ways through my university career, and how, in a sense, a lot of my philosophical work is that journey back and back away from institutional practice, away from deeply abstract philosophical thinking, back to proximity, back to a sense of relationship, back to a sense of being placed rather than traveling around the world, and back to a sense of that very close relationship within my family as well, and a back to the ordinary, back to the everyday. So it's a fairly almost labyrinthine, and it's kind of coming back the same journey I traveled out. But that's sort of the structure that's probably going to end up in the book. But it's a kind of a combination of creative nonfiction and reflection and philosophical work and lots of different things. But it's again coming back to that integration that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
You know, that sense of how do you find integration as a person, as a thinker, while also finding an artistic way to express that integration when you're living a life where you don't have the luxury and the privilege of a full-time academic career. And that's normally the experience of women. And one of the journeys back home has been, I started off thinking that my father was my primary influence, and now realizing that I probably more in common with my mother on a daily basis than I ever did with my father, who was one of the most deeply impractical men you could possibly think of. I've changed way more nappies than my dad ever did.
Great. Okay, well, Anthony, I'll definitely take up your invitation, and also I'll look with interest for when you eventually publish that book. And thank you very much for a fascinating and very enjoyable conversation.
Thank you very, very much yourself, Barry. Thank you.
You can find out more about Middleway philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.